listeners. We are here today, Christina Borgeson and
Celia Farber,
with yet another installment of the Whistleblower Newsroom. And we're very pleased to have our current guest, Andrew Krieg, on. He's a lawyer and a public affairs commentator and legal reformer based in Washington, D.C., with decades of experience in cutting-edge public policy issues. Drawing on extraordinary contacts in the nation's capital and globally, he is currently examining pivotal developments, many of them secret, which is why we want to hear about them here on the Whistleblower Newsroom. Anyway, these pivotal developments transforming the American way of life. He provides his findings by his articles, lectures, broadcast interviews, books, and through two organizations, a nonpartisan legal reform group, the Justice Integrity Project, and a public affairs consultancy that he leads called Eagle View Capital Strategies. Welcome, Andrew.
Well, I'm so glad to be here with you both. Thank you for having me.
Welcome, Andrew. It's quite a news morning. I wanted to start by asking you this headline that struck me as just pretty shattering, that the DOJ reached an agreement with Clinton lawyers to block FBI access to Clinton Foundation emails. First, let me just ask you, did you see that breaking news this morning?
I'm afraid I didn't. I was updating her website with the New Zealand massacre.
Yeah. Okay.
And actually, I was in court yesterday for a Roger Stone hearing, so catching up. But
well, Christina and I refer to this whole thing. Well, I do anyway. I don't know if Christina agrees, but I call it the everything bagel because everything is balled up into this enormous mega. It's not a scandal. It's just the total rot, right, of our whole society, essentially our whole government and institutions, and we're all trying to make heads or tails of it. And the reason you seem to know more about Barack Obama, his roots, than just about anybody I've ever spoken to. So that's why we wanted to just jump in there, because I think very few of us understand. How did we get
here?
A little historical
context, starting with Obama up to what's going on now with Trump and Mueller and, you know.
Yeah, or like how you see
Hillary Clinton's, legal team being able to get the DOJ to not allow the FBI to have access to the emails on her private servers. Can you give us the Shakespearean account of all this starting with?
Well, yes. And in fact, I just did it last night. I was at a law school reunion and catching up with some friends overlooking the Potomac River. And I said some of them I hadn't seen for some time, and people ask what you're doing. And I said I like to frame things in terms of a question on some of these deep issues. So I'm just not yakking and sounding like a know-it-all. And so let me do that here. I said, I don't think you can really understand the Obama administration unless you know what his first job was after he got out of college and why it's important and what his mother's first job, or what his mother's career was, and why that was important. And people, even very knowledgeable Washingtonians or others, will look at me with almost a blank stare, and they don't know. And I sometimes gently say, well, he's a two-term president. So here's the answer. His first job was with a company called Business International Corporation. And it was only later that he became a community organizer. And Business International Corporation, as befits its somewhat dreary name, was in the import-export business. And that, some people may remember, is what James Bond did. when he was asked what he did, he said he worked for Universal Exports, because it sounds so boring that no one would drill down. But I went to, with Wayne Madsen, a friend of mine, in 2009 to the National Archives, and he says, you've really got to learn to look up declassified CIA documents. And in there, we saw that the person running Business International, the owner, said it was a front company for the CIA.
Oh, interesting.
Oh.
Ah,
interesting.
Yes.
Okay.
So if you're a community organizer after you work for the CIA front company, that makes a difference.
Yes, it does.
And it's not necessarily entirely negative, because as I point out in my book about this presidential puppetry, my own mother had worked for patriotic reasons with the CIA. Her main thing was she was a very well-known medical writer, globe-trotting medical writer. But she had relationships with the CIA, and she'd sometimes talk about it in the 60s, and she'd mention this guy, Colonel J.C. King, that she worked with. And on this same trip to the National Archives, I looked him up, and I said, oh my gosh, he's head of Western Hemisphere operations for the CIA.
Wow.
And so when people say, well, how can people have a secret job? I say, it's easy.
Yeah.
By the way, that just to kind of curtail this historical aspect and get to the current times, President Obama's mother worked for somebody named Peter Geithner at the Ford Foundation. So she was an anthropologist. Peter Geithner was head of their Asian programs. He's the father of Tim Geithner, the banker and treasury secretary.
Oh, interesting.
And virtually nobody in Washington, even people who cover the Treasury Department, would know that.
Wow.
And so people think, well, why would Obama appoint former head of the New York Reserve to be treasury secretary when the New York Federal Reserve Bank was implicated in, you know, kind of the financial scandals leading up to the Great Recession then.
Right.
Well, the point is that his family on both sides was connected. And as we move into the present time and we look at these names coming at us, these possible presidential candidates and or actual candidates, possible presidents, who's doing this kind of research on their background? You know, because we were told the story of President Obama, and by the way, I attended his first fundraiser, which was at a friend of mine's home, and it cost $2,300 to attend.
Wow.
And and I report these findings not, it's just the kind of things that people need to know, but it's not, from my point of view, negative, except in the sense that why haven't people been more forthcoming about it? But it, to some extent, it's positive. You know, the right wing attacked him relentlessly for just being a community organizer, they said, who doesn't know anything about foreign policy.
Well, by the way, you remember that WikiLeaks released a document from John Podesta's email account. Remember
yes.
that? Where written by Michael Froman,
mm-hmm.
who was a Citigroup executive.
Yes.
And it proposed Obama's cabinet, Robert Gates as Secretary of Defense, Eric Holder as Attorney General, Janet Napolitano, Secretary of Homeland Security,
yes.
Rahm Emanuel, Chief of Staff, the entire list, and that's who became Obama's cabinet.
Yes, and Froman goes back to Harvard Law School. I think he was a classmate of Obama's there. And so...
yeah, but a Citigroup executive
basically
picked his yes. Cabinet for him.
Yes, exactly. And this has never really been published. I've been meaning to publish it in some form, but I'll try to do it here. But a group
Poor Assange published it, and
oh yeah,
where he didn't go so well.
Exactly. By the way, one of the things I was doing this morning was I was going back to my stories about Assange beginning in late 2010, and I know you probably want to get into that, but I'll just mention that I had gotten a tip that Karl Rove was a force behind his prosecution.
No doubt.
And I started writing stories about that in December 2010 for Huffington Post was first, and I explored the basically the frame up of Assange in a bipartisan way between figures from the Bush administration and the Obama administration, many of them associated with Hillary Clinton, who really, really wanted him taken out.
Right.
And what one specific scoop that I got from somebody who used to work with Karl Rove on all kinds of dastardly deeds, but became a whistleblower. And she told me that Rove was an advisor to the Prime Minister of Sweden at the time of Assange's setup.
Right.
I've seen that. And maybe I read it from you.
Well, of course, Celia, you've done great work on that element, too.
Well, I have a little bit of an inside track on Sweden. I think it's a very underreported part of the story.
Yes.
Sweden's deep state and its relationship to America's deep state.
Oh, yeah.
And the fix on Assange.
Oh, yes. And of course, somewhat maybe belatedly, I got into the Stieg Larsson novels.
Oh, you did?
Because a lot of people might do it reverse and become enraptured with the novels and movies first and then get to real life.
Wait, you got to tell the public, you got to tell our listeners who that is.
Yeah, a trilogy about the dark underbelly of Sweden.
I think the general takeaway though is that people have to stop looking at the world as Republican and Democrat or left or right or whatever.
Right.
They have to really, really, really start paying attention to it's the elite and everybody else. I mean,
Obama's an elitist.
These deep state people who run the deep state, it's the elites, you know, it's people who are hidden from view, and you know they are the puppet masters for the agencies, the leaders of the agencies of these various governments, you know, including our own.
Well, let's start very basic then. Andrew, may I ask a very basic question?
Sure.
Just yesterday I was having a discussion with somebody about Barack Obama. And I said, I had seen reportage and picked up on it myself and written about it a little bit on my website, that Obama, which I thought was very interesting, that he got Saudi funding, and that's how he got into Harvard via,
his tuition was paid by a Saudi prince, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, bin Talal. Does that sound right to you?
It does. I haven't researched that specifically, but
okay. Let me get to what I wanted to ask you though. Was this guy said, "Oh, but what do you mean? Barack Obama came from very humble beginnings, and he came from nothing in village in Africa." Is that? I don't really particularly care
by
where
the way,
he was
that's
born,
alleged. Okay, but like, that he was. By the way, I just want to say it's alleged that his tuition was paid by this guy. We really. I don't have
the checks.
Yeah, I don't have.
Okay. Yeah.
Actually, we shouldn't even that mention was, it if we don't know. You know
well, I
no,
know
I said it was reported. It was reported by Jack Cashel.
Jack Cashel.
Anyway, this whole business of leaving aside where he was born, but the whole sort of origin myth of Barack Obama, what can you tell us about that? Can you? Where did that come from? And what was his origin? What was his early life like? Okay, what's the real story?
I think the real story is that that the real story is totally confused by political propaganda from both the right and left, and part of it emanates from his camp. For example, if you kind of reverse engineer this, and you say, okay, all of these kind of conservative attacks on Obama's birthplace, and Jerome Corsi, who's a leader of this, is kind of a friend of mine, and I've got his book, he's autographed it, and I know him. You can see that it's all a political stunt, because none of those voices who seem to care so much about proving Obama's birthplace have anything to say about Ted Cruz, who was born in Canada.
Yeah, but before we go into some long
but he was never president
disquisition about I really want to get to
it's propaganda is what I'm saying,
right?
And that's the larger point.
Yeah, but let's talk in a straight line.
Okay.
Obama, you know, has,
Obama's DOJ.
He's an intelligence guy. He's a CIA connected guy. All of a sudden, he becomes president. Is he a made guy? Who made him president?
Well, I think it's a more complicated process than that. I would use the analogy of
he was barely a senator for a few, you know.
Right. There's many puppet masters, and they are not united. And so it's an evolving process of the culture. Because someone is a billionaire in the banking industry doesn't mean that their interests are totally aligned with a billionaire from the agriculture sector, except maybe reducing taxes and so forth. So he was one of a number of people who was encouraged, and he showed skills and ability and rose to the top. So it's not that one person anointed him or one small group anointed him, but there is surrounding him a lot of secrecy, and some of the elites have tried to disparage him.
Well, I think he performed quite well for the elites. I mean, he certainly tried to keep the journalists in line. He kept the wars going. He had his drone program.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody in the banking industry.
Total globalist.
Nobody in the banking industry was held accountable. Okay, so then he goes.
But what happens to the Department of Justice during his presidency? I have heard many people say Obama weaponized the DOJ. Does that resonate with you?
Not really, because the Justice Integrity Project was founded basically to go after injustices that had become apparent during the Bush administration. And to my great disappointment, Obama did not really, and Holder did not dig into the worst abuses, but they didn't start that process.
The Bushes did.
Well, no, I would take it back farther. I'm very active in efforts to have honest investigations of the pivotal 1960s assassinations.
Mm.
And that's JFK, Martin Luther King,
and our
RFK and Malcolm X. Right. And for three of those involving the Kennedys and Martin Luther King, the family members have come out in the last year more publicly and courageously and said they do not believe the official story. And that, you know, younger people that I run into constantly say, well, that's in the past. We don't care about that. And
But the past is prologue.
I have to say, yes, there's all kinds of the Rosetta Stone to understanding today. And it leads to new looks at Iran-Contra, the drug epidemic in the United States. I know in your book, Christina, Into the Buzzsaw, you have Gary Webb, and I've got two shelves of books on official involvement in the narcotics trade. And so you're right earlier when you said all of this is part of a piece, but unless people understand that Lee Harvey Oswald was a patsy who was really a government agent, and anybody who looks at the evidence honestly knows that, I would have to say.
Yeah.
And that has just incredible implications for all kinds of other cover-ups.
Well, that leads us up, you know, we can follow that trail all the way up to the present moment to, you know, something, Zrock saying exactly, you know, which is all of a piece, and I'll explain why. You know, when he says that the Justice Department negotiated with the FBI to protect Hillary from having her emails read by the FBI, what you have is these state malfeasance, criminal activities, et cetera, that are now covered up as a matter of course. Things, you know, things are rigged, you know, regulations, laws, et cetera, are rigged to protect people at the highest levels, and by the same token, they also pass legislation so that they can do, you know, get closer and closer to calling Julian Assange a terrorist, and or as Pompeo, what did Pompeo call him? He's the head of a hostile non-state intelligence gathering organization. Well, every journalism outlet is an intelligence gathering operation, and sometimes it is hostile to the government and to the government's activities, you know. And the interesting distinction between a regular outfit like Fox or MSNBC and Assange is simply the curator of a platform. He doesn't go out and gather the intelligence. The intelligence comes to him. It's more like a whistleblowing platform, I think.
But also he revolutionized, I would say, total paradigm shifter or shatterer for journalism, which is why I can understand they just cannot stand him and are terrified of WikiLeaks have been, because it's original documentation. It's no more gatekeeper.
But as Assange goes, this is what the journalists who can't stand Assange and think he's a traitor and so on, this is what they don't understand, is as Assange goes, so goes journalism.
Yep.
All of a sudden, anything that you say that's, you know, critical can be, you know, construed as hostile, and hostile to the government, hostile to national security. And now, all of a sudden, you know, the new when was the amendment to the Espionage Act? Was that in 2018, May 2018, where they said now if you say anything?
But see, my sense of recent history is that a lot of that flowered under the Obama administration. A lot of those repressions, a lot of those. Andrew, what do you think about that?
I think
I know it goes further back, but and the reason I'm dwelling here on Obama is because I've heard many commentators say that the present crisis, which our previous guest Ray McGovern called FBI Gate, not Russia Gate. They keep saying it all goes back to Barack Obama. I don't know if it does or doesn't, but I want to know what you think about that.
Well, I have a lot of respect for Ray McGovern.
He didn't say that, by the way, but other comments specifically that I know.
Well,
he called it FBI Gate. That's
yeah,
what I'm
saying. Yeah, he said it shouldn't be called Russia Gate. It should be called FBI Gate.
Well, I think things are much more complicated.
Well, he said that because they didn't go after the forensic evidence. That's what why he was saying.
This is a crisis of the FBI, he says.
Well, I
among other
disagree.
Things.
I think it's much more nuanced. I think you can find huge problems, as I mentioned, before the Obama administration. There, if you focus very narrowly on selected areas, I think you'd find some more serious breaches than during the Bush administration. But I think it's fundamentally wrong to think that the Obama administration is worse across the board in terms of civil liberties
than the Bush
administration.
I agree.
Trump, for that matter.
I agree with you 100%. I think they're all in line with each other, though. That's the whole point.
Well, I think there are differences, and I think on the whole,
on keeping control of the press, on continuing the wars, and so on. I mean, de facto, they're in line with each other, aren't they?
They are, but there's nuances. So, for example, I believe that after Obama was reelected to a second term, you would find he had more freedom in some ways to act on a more Democratic Party-oriented type of values. It's not a unitary system.
Listen,
so, for example, in Syria, he did not do the bombing that was wanted in September 2013, and I give him credit for that, and he endured a lot of criticism from neocons and all kinds of other people because he wasn't courageous enough to bomb Syria for the alleged chemical attacks. And I think his foreign policy background that was hidden actually worked to the betterment of world peace on that.
Andrew, I hope you'll come. We can have a future show and delve deeper into Obama, but I'm very curious. You were just at the Roger Stone, what was it, hearing?
Yes, yes.
And that's kind of fallen away from the news. What made you go? What made you interested? And what did you see and hear?
Well, I cover all these things. Manafort, Michael Flynn, their hearings. I covered the Manafort trial and his sentencing on Wednesday of this week. And so I'm a regular at this because it brings to bear all of these concepts of hidden agendas, intelligence, propaganda, the performance of the news media.
Yeah, but speaking of it, may I just ask you head
sure.
on, do you know anything about the tip-off to CNN, presumably from the FBI before the raid?
Well, that could have been a tip-off, and it could have been just good reporting. And
okay.
So, you know, I covered the Justice Department full-time for 5 years for a newspaper before I became a reporter. And sometimes you get some little hint, and sometimes you just you're both reporters. Sometimes you just think things through. So I got
to ask both of you, though, do you think it's kosher that there are straight-up FBI agents, former FBI, the one guy, I can't remember his name, worked under Comey, who now work at CNN openly? Or is it just me? You know, this
conflagration. Well, you know what? I mean, I think it cuts two ways because I think they think, oh, you know, the former FBI guy, he has all this institutional knowledge. He knows, he understands procedures, and he can make comments and so on as an expert, you know, commentator. But by the same token, he might be loyal to his past institution, to that institution, and blow smoke sometimes when he wants to protect the institution. I know. I was absolutely shocked, for example. I worked with CBS's law enforcement consultant who was a former bomb squad guy on the TWA, the explosion of TWA off the coast of Long Island in 1996. And all of a sudden, he lost his job. I lost my job for asking questions about what the eyewitnesses saw going up and all of a sudden the plane exploding. And guess who replaced the law enforcement consultant at that time? James Kastrom, the guy, the FBI guy in charge of the criminal investigation of TWA to see whether or not there was a bomb or missile. He was brought on. I mean, and it to me, I'll be honest, I'm not saying it was, but it felt like a sinecure for a job well done on a cover-up. Sure.
Well, exactly, and you write about that in Into the Buzzsaw, your chapter on that. And, you know, the courage you showed is obvious. I just as an overview and maybe to touch briefly on the Roger Stone hearing, which has been underreported. There's so much other news. My position is virtually any significant news organization has very serious problems that you can focus on, scandals, perhaps, if they've been around long enough. My own favorite writer and reporters have extremely embarrassing parts of their lives, I've discovered. And so it's universal. But we have to look also that even somebody who's done some bad things sometimes says good things. So I think that's the way to approach things. And in terms of the Roger Stone hearing, what the judge did was she confounded people on both the right and left, many of whom were thinking, oh, she's going to throw Roger Stone in jail because he's been jerking her around with trying to get his side of the story out and violating a gag order, most recently with he's got a new book about his case out, and he didn't tell the judge when she said to ensure a fair trial, you've got to stop criticizing Mueller and this prosecution and commenting on your court case. And he clearly played a cute little game by not telling her that he had a book coming out on it with a new introduction. And people thought, oh my gosh, she's going to slam him Thursday.
And she didn't.
Trial for what, everybody? Trial for what? What did Roger Stone do?
Well, he's under indictment for perjury, I believe.
Because he said he did not have... Okay, so this is about Assange, Contact, WikiLeaks, DNC.
Yes, yes.
Okay, WikiLeaks said they have never had any contact with Roger Stone. And Assange announced, as we all know, in 2006, June, I think it was, that he was going to drop these DNC emails. So why is it relevant whether Roger Stone... Can you clarify?
Well, I'll try to explain that, but just to finish the other point. What the judge did was, and by the way, Roger Stone was online just in front of me to get into the courthouse, and I was running late. And the hearing was supposed to be at 9:34, and he only arrived at 9:25 and didn't even start to get through the press until after the hearing was supposed to start. So, you know, it's all a small thing. And you know what the judge did? She said, look, what's past, we're not going to focus on the past. We're going to set a schedule for the case. And she methodically went through when the various briefings are due, set a trial date for November 5th, and there was no fireworks. And that's the process as it should be, in a way. But to get into the larger case, there are mysteries that I'm open to new evidence on. And so I'm not, even though I do think Assange was framed in a basically honey trap situation in Sweden that's really outrageous, that doesn't necessarily prove the facts on this more current case. And until you get people under oath and cross-examination, we're not going to know. And by the way, I was sitting with one of Roger Stone's helpers on the case, actually two of them, and outside, as he walked away, he shook the hand of both the lawyer standing next to me and me, because I've got all of Roger's books autographed, and I just want to ask you something.
I think the issue is they're trying to get somebody to say that Assange collaborated with or colluded with people to get those emails.
Right.
Because if they can prove that he actually, you know, actively sought that stuff, then they can get him.
Right.
But
right.
And so that's why I think Stone, you know, they're looking at Stone.
Wait,
and Stone.
Why can they actively get him if he actively sought the stuff?
Because it'd be conspiracy.
Right.
Journalists actively seek information. Where's the line where he crosses into conspiracy?
Journalists cannot actively conspire to illegally receive information.
Right. Illegally receive it. Right. I thought Roger Stone just said, presumably to Trump, am I right, that there's a big email drop coming on WikiLeaks, and he claimed he had been in touch with Assange. Is that everybody's understanding?
He was giving the impression, and now he's saying no. But, you know,
right.
That's why he's now in the trouble he's in, because, you know, he was giving the impression that he was all part of this.
So blowing his horn.
Right. And sometimes people do that. But sometimes they are in touch. And by the way, in the world of spies and intrigue, often people will use what's called cutouts.
Yes.
Or intermediaries. So what the government is trying to do is say, okay, we think we know that Stone said he's in touch. He's now saying he was just blowing his smoke. But how did this information get to Assange?
Well, that's the interesting thing is, you know, they're so hot to go after Stone, and they're so hot to go after all these other people, and yet they weren't hot, the FBI was not hot to, or the Mueller investigation for that matter, they weren't hot to get the actual forensic evidence, to get the actual computers, to review, to look at the forensic evidence that those computers had to offer. And that had to be done by Bill Binney and a couple of other former NSA guys to discover that, you know, there was, according to Binney, who's like a techno genius, you know, there was no hacking. That this was the speed at which the information was taken out of those computers had to do with using a thumb drive, and so it had to be somebody who was in there, and you know, putting the thumb drive physically into the computer. So, you know, they can indict all the people they want, but it would be, you know, the forensic evidence, you have to pay attention to it, and nobody ever mentions it.
Well, I know Bill Binney. I respect him. I've written many stories about his lectures and his courage and his public service and his expertise. But my current position is I'm neither a prosecution mentality or a defense mentality, and I'd like to see. In some forum, there probably won't be any grand forum unless there's a trial, but I'd like to see Bill Binney discuss his view of this with people who have a different view and also have forensic
knowledge. I'll bet you he would be thrilled to do that.
Well, I bet. As well,
and
but here's the problem.
You know,
the problem.
line them up.
Well, yeah, I'd love to.
Bill would be right on there.
Yeah. I'm working on it, but let me tell you the two problems. One, you have an ongoing case, and so so who exactly is on the other side that has the technical?
Is it Tom Drake and those guys?
Listen, it's not even who has the technical, because there are plenty of people who have the technical expertise. The thing is that there was no examination on the part of the people who were supposed to be looking into it of the forensic evidence. That is my point. Just
well, we don't. I'm not sure.
They did not.
That's, well,
it is true. It is true.
Okay, there are people at the FBI who cyber sections who reportedly, and I'm looking at things like the Michael Iskoff book, who was at these hearings, but who claim to know things about Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear and the markings and the forensic evidence. And here's the two obstacles to the kind of
listen,
discussion.
The FBI came out. I'm sorry to break through here, but I've just got to break through here and tell you, the FBI, when asked why they didn't look at the computers, why they didn't take the computers and examine them, they said, oh, the DNC rebuffed our request. Okay? So
well, yeah.
Why are you so disinterested? And you're telling me you can't subpoena, you can't get a warrant for those, computers?
Well,
come on, Andrew.
No, I'm
come
on. Well, I'm familiar with that, but let me give another viewpoint. These discussions, these debates, are heavily charged with people who want to achieve a desired result.
Let's not talk about, you know, mushy stuff around the edges.
Okay, well,
what do you know about the FBI not going after those computers? That's what I would like to know. Because forensic evidence, that's a bottom line in my book. And in the book of any good investigator.
Hillary Clinton and are very suspicious of the Democrats and so forth, have scant tolerance for the concept of privacy for what they were doing at that time.
But you're not answering my question.
I'm trying to. So my second and final sentence on this is that at that time, the Democrats were running a presidential campaign, and they did not want all of their stuff
They were screwing Bernie Sanders, right? Of course they didn't want all their stuff.
That's one view. But another view is that they did not necessarily want everything in their computers going to the FBI and potentially subject to freedom of information.
Well, they were the ones who called the FBI and said that their computers had been hacked.
That's not my understanding.
What is your understanding?
My understanding is that the FBI went to a mid-level person on the help desk and said, you know, we monitor what Russia is doing, and you've got a problem. And the person on the help desk, who you can imagine is busy in the middle of a presidential campaign.
Where did you get this information? I don't know if that's what happened at all.
Well, let me just jump in here. So,
well,
Andrew, you think
in the book Russian Roulette on approximately.
It may be in a book, Russian Roulette, but
okay.
My question
on approximately pages 73 to 76.
Yeah, just because it's in a book.
Whose book is that? Let's.
Michael Iskoff and David Horn.
Well, that doesn't make it true.
Doesn't make it true, but on the other hand, I'd like to see a discussion between Bill Benny, who I know very well, and Michael Iskoff.
Iskoff? Oh, is he that big IT expert? Michael Iskoff? Come on.
Let's have another
IT expert.
Okay, here's another one.
Well, this is a great thing for us to resolve in a future show.
Suggest another guest for your future show. You have Christopher Steele, who is head of British intelligence.
Is he an IT guy?
Pardon me?
Is he an IT guy?
He's a spy.
I know he's a spy. Is he an IT expert? I'm looking for somebody who has expertise.
Believe me, yesterday, before I came on your show, I was brainstorming with somebody how to set up such a debate. Now, here are the two problems. On the government side, you're not going to find somebody from FBI IT forensics who can legally debate Bill Benny.
Yes, you can. You can find a retired IT guy.
No, they're under... By the way, Celia sent me the Lisa's page testimony in advance of the show, and she described how FBI agents in that testimony, 165 pages I read this morning, that she's under permanent...
But it's not a secret. What Bill Binney reviewed, the forensic evidence that he reviewed, it's not classified, it's not secret. Anybody can talk about it.
Why couldn't some other... Well, they could, except that Lisa Page said, I've got FBI counsel here sitting next to me in my testimony, even though I'm no longer working for the government.
Yeah, but nobody's asking Lisa Page to look at the IT information.
But the IT person would be in the same position she is.
Look, I'm telling you, I think that all these barriers that you're talking about aren't real. They're artificial. If there's somebody... You know, I'm sure
maybe
there are people.
I'd love to put on an event in the Washington Convention Center and have it broadcast on all networks of this debate. I put on events and so forth. I'd love to do it.
A debate about the forensic evidence.
Yeah, okay, I'd love to do it.
Andrew,
but having put on scores of events, I have to think about the practical.
Well,
possibilities. And
the
one
expert,
is who exactly is going to be debating Bill Benny? That's the...
It has to be
somebody
with an equal level of expertise.
Yes.
Wasn't there a splinter group with Tom Drake that said they didn't agree with Bill Benny? Is that right? Remember we were looking at that, Christina? There was a group within the VIPs or coming out of VIPs or something that didn't look...
Maybe Tom Drake.
Andrew, you... feel that it's possible that there is a kernel at the heart of Mueller's Russiagate that is valid. Am I right to really simplify it?
Yeah. And we don't know because it's secret.
It's secret. Okay, so we will know when Mueller's report comes out.
No, well, if...
We know a lot of things now. I mean, for example, it depends what you define as Russiagate, but...
That Russia hacked the DNC, primarily, that Russia hacked...
Well, that's
the
just one element.
Right. Okay. Well, I consider...
There's many other...
Christina, do you
elements.
Consider that the core element
yeah,
of
I
Russiagate?
I consider that the core element. That's
wait,
what
you
triggered
don't, Andrew,
this whole thing.
Wait, Andrew, you don't consider that the core of Russiagate?
That's what triggered it.
Well, there's also social media. That I consider BS, the whole thing, because everybody's got bots and trolls and memes.
Well, I think it goes much broader, and it involves large numbers of relationships of the Trump circle to not just Russia, but Eastern European, Central Asian oligarchs and
sure, no doubt,
money laundering, and so forth, and that's you don't need a forensic expert to know that stuff. That's obvious.
If Russia didn't exist, would our election have turned out differently?
If it were so obvious, why do we not have any indictments yet? If it were so obvious, we would have gotten to that. I'm not saying that it may or may not be true. I'm not saying that, but so far, no indictments on any of those counts.
Well, I'm an investigative reporter, and I have vast numbers of, I shouldn't put it that way, but we can read articles about this stuff. We can read books about it. We don't have to wait for the indictments. But the investigation is continuing. And normally... at the end of investigations, as you know, that comes the big news is at the end.
Yeah, the big bang comes at the end. Yes,
yeah,
I know. You eat the little fish to get up to the big fish. But I mean, there doesn't seem to be any indication of that coming.
Look,
I think there's a lot of indications that it's coming.
When CNN throws early questions to Hillary Clinton before a presidential debate, in my estimate, CNN is interfering with the U.S. election. Do you both agree with that?
Well, I agree, but that's one.
A bigger problem than what Russia's doing is what are we doing? What's our media doing? What are our big tech companies doing? What are they doing to manipulate us all the time? That's what we should deal with primarily.
Well,
we should deal with all of it, I think.
Of course. By the way, on the just
of course,
front.
Russia does what Russia. We all meddle in each other's election.
We've meddled in all over the world,
and they've meddled in ours from the beginning.
Of course,
is this suddenly such a? No matter how hard I try, I do not understand what this is really about. What's going on here? I can't grab it by the tail quite. Russia Gate.
Well, for one thing, if we define it in a simplistic term, Russia Gate. It's going to leave us with a lot of questions. Just like my view is that the American public doesn't understand Watergate. And we began the program, posed a question about Obama. I would pose the same question about Watergate, which is, of course, the root of Russiagate. If people don't understand specifically what Bob Woodward did before he was a reporter, they can't possibly...
Exactly.
And here's the answer to that one. He worked in Navy intelligence for two of the most important people in the country, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And so he wasn't just a hardworking reporter. He was that, but he was connected.
You know what Walter Pincus, another famous... Washington Post reporter said to me when I interviewed him for my book, Feet to the Fire, he said, and I don't think he said it on, you know, for the record or whatever, but he didn't tell me it was off the record. He goes, you know, Woodward, right before the break-in happened for Watergate, Woodward was coming in. First of all, I couldn't figure out why he was a reporter, and I'm not quoting, okay?
He's connected. Well,
because the guy can't write. And, you know, he couldn't write, and yet he became this big reporter at Washington Post.
Yep.
And then when Watergate was about to happen, all of a sudden, like, Woodward was sleeping at the office. Like, he was expecting something to happen, And, you know, after sleeping a few nights at the office, boom, all of a sudden the break-in occurred, and there he was to cover the break-in. And he said, he always thought that was a little interesting, you know?
Well, there's about 20 books on a revisionist view of Watergate, and I've got most of them. And so we can't understand Russiagate if we don't even understand Watergate. But it's a simplistic term, but I think a lot of people have a very narrow definition that it's all about the hacks. My view is it's a much bigger... array of suspicious contacts between.
It's not. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's very
suspicious
interesting.
Suspicious contacts between who and who?
The Trump, Kushner, Wilbur Ross, Manafort entities, and Russia associated oligarchs seeking to control. Business and elections in the United States.
Yeah, well, you know the whole story about Russia, Trump declaring bankruptcy about six times, and then you know the banks here wouldn't give him money, and the Russians started. He went to the turned to the Russians, and the Russians started getting. And so, you know, there is a problem with the president of the United States. You know, a businessman who's going to want to do business in the future with Russia because, you know, they're the ones buying up his apartments and so on and so forth. So, you know, there's a conflict of interest sort of there between his, you know, maintaining relations with Russia the way maybe, you know, the various government agencies feel, you know, he should be, and you know, maintaining things the way they are in such a way that, you know, he still has access when he gets out of office. And that's a that, but that's a current conflict of interest.
Exactly.
You know,
so, and so, you know, the alleged hack, the alleged WikiLeaks aspects are part of this, but by no means, in my view, at least.
Well, that's what triggered everything. That's what triggered everything, allegedly. You know.
Yeah, I think there's a huge conflict here, though, that's ongoing about the privacy of people's records, including political organizations, versus the right to know. And it's not
That's a very good point. That is a good point. I've wondered about that, too. Yeah. You know, privacy is in conflict with the right to know. And privacy for the individual, and you're now raising privacy for the political organization, right?
Right. I mean, suppose it was your favorite organization, and the FBI said, we want all the records. We think that there's illegal activity. Send us the names of, we want the donors, we want all the emails. And you might say, well, gee, that's not right.
Yeah, but they have to show cause.
Transparency is different for the individual. The political organization should be able to be transparent because they owe the public transparency, right? In other words, when it came out, what was going on? Why would the what was going on at the DNC was pretty filthy. So why wouldn't their donors be owed and their support? Why isn't everybody owed? After it comes out, does that change things in your view?
Well, to some extent, but some people might say, well, for parity, we want all the records of the Republican.
Well, why do you have to have parity? I mean, why do you have to have parity? If you say a crime has been committed over here, why do you have to say, well, we have to have parity?
I think Assange said he didn't find
anything
on the Trump campaign. Isn't that right?
He did
tried.
Say that.
He said he tried very
well,
hard.
Well, I mean, to leap... First of all, any of his comments are highly restricted, and they're. I was thinking about this before the show. I would like to see Australia exercise its power as a ally, or at least something to the U.S., and get him home, and put him under oath back home, and then make it. Independent decision, independent from the U.S., to of whether, you know, the answers warrant anything further or let him live in peace or not. But his unsworn comments, even though I think he's been a horrible victim or a horribly treated victim, have to be looked on as unsworn, uncross-examined comments.
See, WikiLeaks is one thing. It's the documentation that's out there for everybody to read in original form, right?
Well, I mean, WikiLeaks is, if you want to call them a news organization because they release leaked documents, they're the only organization that I know of, maybe there are others, but that I know of that has never released
100%. Well, because
they have 100% record of accurate stuff, you know.
Well, Legitimate. Does something similar, and they have a fairly good record.
Yeah, they're very good. They're very good. So, okay. Well, very interesting.
We're just about out
of time, but so Andrew, if we had a debate in a panel, you would land, it sounds to me,
we
somewhere in the middle, and you would say we need to actually keep debating about
exactly.
All this.
Exactly, these are complicated issues, and I'd love to see the kind of discussion
we gotta go.
We're talking about.
We're out of here, yep. And thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun
thank
harassing you.
You
know I love you.
Thanks.